All today, we're going to get right into Sunday school today. It's Bible conference Sunday, but with Dr. Smith being here, he's preaching the early service and the later service, and so we didn't make him also do Sunday school in the middle. So all of our Sunday school classes are normal today, and so I don't think I see anybody from somewhere else in here, so that's good. Everybody's in the right spot. If you didn't get a handout this morning, raise your hand. We want to make sure everybody got one, and we'll have Brother Paul or Brother Dustin get to you. Everybody's good? We had plenty of time this morning. We didn't know what to do with all our time. I drank a cup of coffee. Brother Doug told me a dad joke or four. And so we had all kinds of time. He just told me this one. But I got to tell you the dad joke. You ready? You ready for the dad joke? No, you're not? Because I can go right to the lesson. Okay. So he just told me this joke literally like 17 seconds ago. Air used to be free at the gas station, right? But now you go somewhere and it costs $1.50. You know why? Inflation. Yeah. He was so pleased to tell me that joke too. I got more kick out of that than anything else. All right, we're going to get right into our lesson today. I'm going to. So you might notice I don't have the scripture written out on the handout. That's because I have so many different references that I could not have, obviously. And so you can go back. I'll refer to each one of them as we go along. I feel really bad. Today is a little bit of an information dump kind of lesson, but the alternative is to not cover some of the important things that I feel like we need to talk about with the subject, or to drag it on for multiple weeks, and I don't want to do that either. I want to highlight just some specifics about this issue. We've been talking these last few weeks about the evils in our world in comparison to the character of God. And this is not only hard for the unbeliever and the skeptic in the world, but it's also difficult for the Christian as well. And so last few weeks, we've been talking about evils in general, and moral evil, and natural evils like disasters and diseases. And we've covered some of those things, so I'm not going to revisit them. But now, for the next couple weeks, I want to talk about specific things that people consider to be evil and bad that are in the Bible itself. Why is it that there is so much war and death in the Bible that God seems to be okay with? If hell is so bad, why is it that it exists at all? Why is God allowing it to be? And today, before we get to those two, we're going to talk about those the next 2 weeks. We're going to talk about one that comes up a lot. Why would God allow slavery in the Bible? And so I'm not going to be able to cover everything, but we're going to try to give some highlights today. When we talk to people about certain things in our world, for example, and you know, you'll talk to an atheist or an unbeliever, and maybe they'll doubt whether or not there's actually really good and evil, it's all subjective or whatever. There's certain things that always come up that everyone can agree with is bad. Like the Holocaust is one of those. No matter what the conversation is, no matter what you're trying to do with the conversation, if you bring up the Holocaust, we're all in agreement, that was bad. And so if I want to call somebody a name, I want to call them Hitler. If I want to say that, hey, there is something that's objectively evil, we'll bring that up and we'll say, well, okay, that's one of those. One of the other ones that comes up all the time is slavery. Well, we all agree slavery is bad. Yes, slavery is bad. Okay, we're on the same page. And then you can move forward. So if that's one of the ones that's just so obvious, then why is it that it's in the Bible? Well, the unbeliever, the skeptic would say, well, apparently God's not as good as you're saying that he is. But our response is that we want to look into what the Bible actually has to say. Now, remember, in this conversation, what is happening is that we're saying that God's character is inconsistent. What you're saying God's character is inconsistent with the biblical story. So what that means is that we have the license to look at the biblical story and see whether or not it says what it feels like it's saying at times. Now, I do want to say a couple things, and the first main thing is this, that there is innumerable passages and things to deal with that I just cannot. There's a lot of different things to talk about, but I want to give you the highlights. I'm not going to have you turn to every passage. If you're fast, you can. I'm going to refer to a lot, and I gave them to you. There's going to be certain passages I want you to turn to because it's just long enough that it gives us enough of an insight into something, and we can look through it, and so I'll tell you when those are. Deal? All right, so the first thing I want to do, I'm going to sandwich this whole lesson in with some positive things, the first point and the last point. The first thing I want to do, number one, is talk about the biblical theology of the slave. The biblical theology of the slave. And what I'm seeking to do in this first point is simply do this. If we're going to talk about one specific passage in the Bible that's sticky and that says some things that bothers us. Now, if you've read through your Bible in a year, you've walked through the whole Old Testament law at some point. And undoubtedly, you come across certain passages where you're like, wow, that kind of bothered me a little bit. And you move on because you have to read 3.5 chapters today in order to stay on your schedule and you go on with your life. But you've probably encountered some passages that bother you. Before we talk about any of those, what we have to talk about is that the Bible gives a big, grand story in which every one of those difficult passages finds itself. So what point number one is to do is to give the big, grand story about how we view people, or how God views people. So I'm going to give each one of these individually, but I want us to see that big arc in the whole Bible. So number one, mankind is made in the image of God. This is how the Bible begins. God makes creation good. God makes man, Genesis 1:27, in his image. Male and female created he them. And so you have two humans, and that is it. And both of them, it specifies, were made in the image of God. Man is intrinsically valuable. Both of the humans that existed were. Now, there was only two people on the earth, and so he considered all of them to be made in God's image. Now, similar to my answer in the whole question of moral evil, one of the things I said was, if we're to complain about the evils in our world and the suffering in our world, one of the things we're also conceding is that Christianity is true. Because the idea that God exists and man is valuable and his creation is good is necessary to believe in order for the questions of all these evils to even make any sense. If we're just saying things just are, things just happen, or people just are, you know, animals that got better, then for us to treat them as tremendous ills when bad things happen is to dump into it a lot of purpose and meaning that our worldview doesn't say is actually there. Likewise with this, some of the passages we're going to talk about are going to be a little sticky. However, the only reason that slavery is such a big deal to so many people is we all realize that humans are intrinsically valuable, right? And therefore they should be treated as such. But it's not the atheistic worldview that gets to make that claim. It's the Christian worldview that sets up the stage that says humans are intrinsically valuable. That's how the story begins. If you're an atheist, you believe in evolution. You have to, which means that humans are just evolved animals. We're just better animals than the other ones. We just happen to be in charge of the world, but somebody else could be. We just are. And not only that, we would believe that more than likely, one version of one country of humans might have evolved past another country of humans. And so, in essence, some people are more valuable than others under the evolutionary standpoint. And so all of that to say is simply this. The Bible begins with the view that God made man, and so because God made man, man is valuable. Because not because of who he is or what he does, but because of what God made him to be. Right? And so this is where the story begins about humanity. Number two, actually, let me give you a couple verses. Proverbs 14 says this, he that oppresseth the poor reproaches his maker. When we oppress those beneath us, who we're reproaching is the one who made us. In Job chapter 31, he actually talks about if he despised the cause of his manservant or his maidservant when they contend with him. And he says, I shouldn't look down on my servants when they come to me because, verse number 15 of that passage, he says, did not he that made me in the womb make him? And so his answer is, I should treat my servants with respect because they were made just the same as I was. So the biblical story begins with man is made in the image of God, therefore man is intrinsically valuable. Number two, or letter B. The first mention of slavery is related to a curse. The first mention in the Bible of slavery is related to a curse. Now, work, by the way, is not a bad thing. Man was made to work in Genesis 1 and 2. However, when a curse came on the earth in Genesis chapter 3, work and labor turned into toil. and turned into difficulty. But the first time you actually see slavery properly talked about is in Genesis chapter 9. Now, we all know the story of the flood. This is the thing you put on the wallpaper in nurseries, which I've always thought was a funny thing, because it's like the one time where God judged the most number of people all at the one time, and we paint our nurseries with it. And it's okay, because the elephant's smiling. Meanwhile, you know, there's all the judgment on the earth. But anyway, I've always thought that was a funny thing. But when you get to the end of that story, we all know the story. Noah, he saves his family with the ark, right? And then we land on the mountain, they come out, everything's fresh and new, they build an altar, God gives them the rainbow as the sign of his promise to never flood the earth again. But the story doesn't actually end there. That's where our Sunday school lesson ends, because the very last part of the story is very odd. Noah plants a vineyard, Noah makes wine out of his grapes, Noah gets drunk. This is how the story actually ends, believe it or not. There's a reason why it is, but I don't have time to get into that, but Noah gets drunk, and for some reason, Noah, being drunk, is not wearing any clothes. His son, he has Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham walks into his tent, and then he comes out and he tells his brothers what he saw. The insinuation of the whole story is that Ham did something evil in the process, that it wasn't just an accident, but maybe Ham did it on purpose, whatever. Shem and Japheth walk in backwards, they cover up their father, and then what the result of this whole situation, it says that a curse would be on his son, Canaan. Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren. So the point there is simply this. The first time slavery is mentioned in the Bible, it's mentioned as something that was not ideal, but it was a result of sin in communities. It's not what God designed, and yet it results out of problems that we create. This is how the story begins to unfold. Letter C. The next part of the major story that has to deal with servants and slaves is that the great Jewish miracle is freedom from slavery. The great Jewish miracle is freedom from slavery. So you turn in your Bible, you see Genesis, and you see Abraham being made the father of this great nation, and then Isaac and Jacob and Joseph. And once you get to Exodus, where you actually have a whole nation of people that becomes a real nation of people at this point, it takes place when God frees them from slavery. And that is always considered, obviously, to be a good thing. And not only are they supposed to see themselves as people that God has freed, I gave you a couple passages in Leviticus 25, they're God's servants because he freed them from slavery out of being servants from Egypt. But not only that, they are to treat one another, remembering that they're not better than other people, but that they were slaves themselves. I gave you a couple passages. Exodus 22, he says this, 22 verse 21, thou shalt neither vex a stranger or oppress him, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. Exodus 23 verse 9 says, also thou shalt not oppress a stranger, for ye know the heart of a stranger, seeing ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. He even tells them to recognize that each other, we should treat each other that way. Deuteronomy 15, verse 12 through 15, he says, if thy brother and Hebrew man or Hebrew woman be sold unto thee, serve thee 6 years, in the seventh year thou shalt let him go free from thee. I'm going to get back to that. And when thou sendest him out free from thee, thou shalt not let him go away empty. Thou shalt furnish him liberally out of thy flock, out of thy floor, out of thy winepress. Of that wherewith the Lord thy God has blessed thee, thou shalt give unto him. And remember that thou wast a bondman in the land of Egypt, and the Lord thy God redeemed thee. Therefore, I command thee this thing today. So what he says is, he doesn't view his people, though he blessed them, though he chose them, though he wants to work through them, though he wants to bring the Messiah through him, he always reminds them that they're not better than the people around them, but that they were once slaves themselves. And as it's going to be so easy when they're on the top to oppress people beneath them, he reminds them, you were the oppressed group before. And so rather than seeing them as a favored group of people that was intrinsically better than the other people around them, he reminds them, when you treat each other the way that you go about your daily life, remember that you only are in the position that you were because God gave you freedom when you were once slaves. So remember that when you treat other people that way. That's part of the context. Now, as we walk through the entire Old Testament, that's a reminder of who they were. Every time their history is brought up, it begins, we were slaves that were set free. It always begins that way. Let's turn briefly to the New Testament. Letter D, Jesus confronts directly racism. Jesus confronts racism. Now, one of the main motivating factors today that always gets brought up with the conversation of slavery is one race against another. Now, I will say, throughout history, that was not the primary motivating factor at all. That's actually a very recent development in history for in the broad category. It mostly had to do with one country against another, whether they were the same race or not was kind of irrelevant. However, for the sake of argument, we have to recognize that Jesus did not consider, even though he was the Jewish Messiah, came to the Jewish people and spent most of his time with the Jewish people, he directly confronts slavery. I gave you a couple passages. One of them is in Luke chapter 4. He goes back to his hometown, Nazareth. So his people he goes to. So if he's going to be kind and loving and giving towards any people, it's going to be his people. And he says that he's not going to be able to do mighty works there because of their unbelief, but rather God's going to allow mighty works to be done in Gentile regions, not Jewish people. Now, when you get to the first century, the Jews thought that they were literally better than everybody else. They were God's chosen people. Nobody else was. We're better than them. And he reminds him of a couple stories. He says, remember back in Elijah and Elisha's day? There was all these people starving during the famine. Elijah didn't go to any Israelites, but God allowed through Elijah to feed a poor woman from Zarephath, which is in Zidon, which is a different country, which is not Israelite. He says, God fed him and didn't feed anybody else. There was all kinds of lepers in the nation of Israel, but God healed Naaman the Syrian from leprosy. And Jesus brings this up to remind them God cares about the other people around you too, not just you. I gave a couple other passages as well. Remember, of course, Jesus purposely walks through Samaria and he gives the gospel to the woman at the well of Samaria. No other Jew would have done that, John chapter 4. Luke chapter 10, when Jesus tells the story of the Good Samaritan, he purposely makes the Samaritan the hero of the story, and that would have bothered them because that's not how they thought. Jesus praises the faith of Gentile people more than he praises the faith of the Jewish people. The Syrophoenician woman in Mark chapter 7, the Roman centurion in Matthew chapter 8. So one thing that Jesus did that was very out of the box for his area was to recognize that the Jewish people weren't particularly special. They were blessed, but not better than other people. And Jesus confronts that. I do want you to turn to this one, Matthew chapter 19. Matthew chapter 19. This is one of those important, very important points that I want to pay attention to as we go along. Matthew 19. Letter E. Part of the biblical story of how Jesus reacts to things in the law. Letter E. Jesus affirms that laws that allowed for evil things were only because, this is your blank, of the hardness of man's hearts. The hardness of man's hearts. Now, before we read this passage, I want you to know that I know that this is about divorce. I did not know that, but there's a lot of principles that I think are very, very important. So you guys are in Matthew chapter 19. Look at verse number 3. I'm going fast because I have a lot to get to, so I'm trying to give you, not spend too long in each one. Matthew 19, verse 3. The Pharisees come to Jesus. They come to him, tempting him, and say to him, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? Is it lawful? What does it say in the law? Give me the exact details of what's acceptable and what's not. Jesus' response, he says, have you not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female? And he said, for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife. They twain shall be one flesh. Wherefore, they're not more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let no man put asunder. So they say to him, well, then why did Moses command to give a writing of divorcement and to put her away? And he saith unto them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, suffered you to put away your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. Now, obviously, I do know this was about divorce. What does this have to do with slavery? The Pharisees and the lawyers come up to Jesus and they say, what exactly does the law say that you can and can't do in this situation? And Jesus' response was not to turn to the law of Moses. His response was to turn to creation and to say, what did God want us to do? Does that make sense? this is the answer to your question, is not what can I get away with, but what does God want? And so then they say, well, if God doesn't want two people to become one flesh, to ever be put asunder and become two again, then why is there an allowance for it in the law of Moses that if they're divorced, then you give them a writing of divorce? You do it this, you don't just throw her out of the house. You have to do it legally and make sure she has taken care of. Why did he say that if God didn't want it? He said, because you guys are going to do it anyway. Your hearts are hard. You're not going to always meet God's design. And so, since that's the case, Moses put regulations on it to make sure you didn't abuse it as much as possible. But, he says, from the beginning it was not so. So this is Jesus' response. Why are some things in the law of Moses? Because humans are broken and we're going to do stupid stuff. And so if it's going to happen anyway, he's going to meet us where we are. And he's going to tell us how to not oppress each other in situations where we're going to do something anyway. So he regulated things that were going to happen in the real world. But our view of it should be in light of what God designed in creation itself. Does that make sense? So why are there some things in the law of Moses that allow for certain things, like people working for other people for the rest of their life? Because that's the way the world worked. Shouldn't, but it does. So either God's going to meet us where we are, or he's, you know, not. And so what the law of Moses did was met them where they were and put regulations and really dampened the worst parts of it. And so this is very important to the conversation. God doesn't design some people to be over other people. He designs every man to be master of his own field and sitting under his own tree, as one of my authors often said. However, the hearts of man are hard, and therefore they must be regulated from where they are. Letter F. Men are all equal in the gospel before Christ. By the way, our fellows are coming by. If you could take your attendance slip and drop it in the offering plate on the way by, we appreciate it. Men are all equal in the gospel before Christ. A massive affront to the view that the ancient world had of slavery is the gospel itself. Not only does it cause us to see all races equally, both genders equally, but to see all people of varying statuses equally. I gave you a passage. If you want to flip there really quickly, it's important, but it's short. Galatians chapter 3, he's describing, verse 28, he's describing the gospel. And he says, in the gospel, before Christ, being children of God, there is neither Jew or Greek. There is neither bond nor free. There is neither male nor female. You're all one in Christ Jesus. Now, he's not saying that those distinctions don't exist anymore. You don't suddenly not become a Jew the moment you get saved. You don't suddenly not become Greek. You don't suddenly not become a male or not become female. You don't suddenly not become a slave or not become somebody who has a large business where a lot of people worked under it in that world. But we viewed humans as equal before the cross. And that was not how that world thought. Actually, one of the most important books is the book of Philemon to that. I don't know if you ever paid attention really closely to what's happening in Philemon. Philemon, there is a man who has a lot of money, obviously. He is housing the church of Colossae. The church meets at his house. He's not the pastor, but he had a big enough house to keep everybody there. And in this very, 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 very short letter, Paul writes to him, a good man, and he was a rich man. He had people working for him, and he had slaves. One of them had wronged him and ran away. And he met with Paul, and he got saved. His name's Onesimus. Paul sends Onesimus back to Philemon in order to restore this relationship. But this is what he says about how Philemon, the master, is supposed to view Onesimus, his slave. He says in verse number 15 of that small little book, he says, perhaps he therefore departed for a season that thou shouldest receive him forever, not as a servant, but above a servant. Watch, a brother, beloved, especially to me, but how much more unto thee, both in thy flesh and in the Lord. He says this, if thou count me, Paul says, a partner, receive him as myself. He says to the master, he says, see your servant, not as a servant, but better than a servant, a brother, a beloved brother. In fact, why don't you treat him like you would have treated me if I showed up at your house? How would Philemon treat Paul if Paul showed up at his house? Better than probably any one of his guests. And he says, whatever that is, do that for him, because you are his brother, he says, in Christ. You're not better than him before Christ. So see him that way. The gospel is an affront to that view of slavery as well. Letter G. Of course, the biblical arc ends in heaven. In heaven, there are people from every background. In heaven, there are people from every background. Now, specifically, I gave you a couple passages, Revelation 5, Revelation 7, when there's people before the throne praising God, specifically every nation, so we can go back to the whole how God views different races. He doesn't really view them differently, different languages. But the point is, no matter where you were from, if you came to Christ through the blood of Jesus Christ, then you are seen equally before the throne. Every time you see a picture of heaven, there are not stair steps that better people stand higher than others. There is the throne and there is the floor, and all of the people praise him from the same spot. And it does not make a distinction between one and the other. And the only people that there is a distinction between in heaven are those who are rewarded more, but not for those who had more, but for those who served Christ well. That's the only distinction that is made. And so the biblical arc of how God views humanity, all of the difficulty of things in the Old Testament law, it has to be taken and put in the middle of that story. It can't be ripped out as if the rest of the story doesn't exist. And so it has to be seen in light of all of that, especially the New Testament. Now, that takes us to a couple other points, some very specific things that we have to cover, and I'm going to try to do as quickly as I can. Number two, I'm going to give you the slavery context in the world of the Bible. The slavery context in the world of the Bible. So I've just talked about how the Bible's story views it, but what about the Bible's world? I'm going to give you some things very quickly. Letter A, slavery in the ancient Near East was common and oppressive. It was common and oppressive. This does not make it right, by the way. That's not the point. The point is, we must situate some of these stories inside of a world where it very much existed and flourished more or less everywhere. We can't just rip it out and dump the Bible into the 21st century as if that's where it's written. It's not written there. So we know that this is the case from, you know, writings on walls where you have people gathering war captives. Law codes from the ancient world talked about how they were to treat their servants. Enslaved captives of war was very, very common, and it was also written about in their records. They were seen as property most of the times. They were not seen as human beings. If a slave was killed by somebody else, usually the main concern in the law code was that the master lost property. That was how they were treated. That's how they were viewed. The world in which the Bible begins is situated in a world where one man often owned another, and that was often, usually, open to abuse. And it wasn't going to go away overnight. Doesn't make it good. It just makes that true. What the law of Moses could do was bring revolutionary ideas to squelch the abuse that was taking place in that world. That's what it could do. So, letter B. I also want to make this very, very, very important distinction. This is one of the most important, just like the Matthew 19 passage earlier, this is one of the most important points that we're going to make. Letter B, biblical servanthood was not American chattel slavery. Biblical servanthood was not American chattel slavery. This is one of the most important points of the entire lesson. C.S. Lewis often talks about how we can have chronological snobbery, which means this, that everything we've learned, we just dump that information onto a previous generation as if they were supposed to be in the same spot that we are. But there's also evidence of chronological ignorance. So one of the problems, and this is probably, so I want you to listen very carefully. This is probably one of the most important points of the entire morning. One of the biggest issues with this entire conversation is really a lack of understanding that comes with the ambiguity of the word servant. When we hear servant, we just immediately dump into that word a slave who's not considered a human and is only considered property, probably stolen from somewhere else, and now they work for somebody. Permanently for the rest of their life, most likely abused. That's what we dump into that word. The problem is, though that happened in the ancient world often, that's not what the word servant entails. It can, but not necessarily. In fact, one of my authors said, really what the word for servant means in the Old Testament, abed is the Hebrew word, it really just means a worker that has a superior. That's what the word means. Now that could mean anything, right? How many of you here work and you have a superior? You are all servants, according to the biblical use of that word. Now, if you were a slave, you are a worker, and you have a superior. So you'd use that word there as well. So you have to recognize that underneath the word servant in the Hebrew Bible is actually a broad swath of most human beings in different contexts and different times. How many of you have read a passage and one king walks up to another king and says, thy servant comes before thee. And he's referring to himself. Well, he's not a slave, but he's saying respectfully, you are my superior king as he's going into his court. And he would use the word. Nobody would say it today, you're slave. But the point is, that was how they viewed that word. So we have to be, what our problem is, we're dumping in our understanding of very narrow understanding into a word that actually had a broad range of meaning. It did happen in the way that we often think, but it often didn't happen that way as well. There's a lot of other things I want to say with that, but I'm just going to leave it alone at that. So biblical servanthood was not American chattel slavery. So many times it shows up, we're not even dealing with the same thing. And so it's really a part of our chronological ignorance that we're thinking that. Letter C. This is also tremendously important. Debt was a common reason for servanthood. Debt was a common reason for servanthood. And so you really wouldn't have been considered a slave. You would just be saying, I work for you until my debt is paid off. So rather than working to gain money, you work to pay off money. Rather than throwing in prison and going to a work camp, you just worked for the person you owed money to until you worked the money off. And so the Bible would call that person, Hebrew, an abed. They had a superior. And so debt was often a situation where you would find yourself in. In Leviticus chapter 25, it gives this whole law specification for what you can do, and it uses this terminology that you sell yourself when you have a debt. But when it uses the terminology you sell yourself, what it really means is you're hiring yourself out, which we all do on a weekly basis. We hire ourselves out in order to get money back. We work for a superior. They pay us. They are our master. We work for them. And so the picture is very similar to a lot of things that we do today. The Bible does even say this. Remember Proverbs 22, the rich rules over the poor, the borrower's servant to the lender. You borrow money, you owe them. You do. And so there's a lot of situations in the Old Testament where that was actually a big part. Now, what's really, really cool throughout the Old Testament law, specifically the law of Moses, is that it cared about the poor people. In most areas of the ancient world, the poor were like, sorry, man, forget you. I guess you just figure it out. But throughout the law of Moses, there was a lot of regulation specifically for the poor to help them, which was quite revolutionary for their time, just so you know. We live in the 21st century where there's a lot of welfare, there's a lot of allowances, there's a lot of aid, and in the ancient world, there just was not. There just wasn't. And if you were to follow the law of Moses, the poor were supposed to be helped. So for example, I gave you a couple passages. The people who owned land were required not to harvest it all. They were required to leave the corners unharvested so that the poor could come in onto their property whenever they wanted at their leisure and glean from the corners of the field. That's what Ruth did. Remember, Ruth went to Boaz's field and gleaned from the field. She walked onto someone else's property. They wanted to make sure that they had food. Now, the ideal was that there was no poor in the land, but since there would be, they were commanded to help. They were supposed to lend to Israelites, their brothers and sisters in their same country. They were supposed to lend to them without interest. They were supposed to forgive debts every 7 years. Wow, no society functions that way. They had a rest day every week, every 7 days. They had a rest year every 7 years, and then they had a big reset year every seven years. So the 50th year would be a reset as well. That just doesn't happen in the ancient world. But they canceled debts every 7 years. So really, if you were a debt servant, you weren't going to be a debt servant for longer than whatever happened to be the rest of the 7 years were. That was the way it was supposed to work. That's the way that God had designed it. In fact, in Deuteronomy chapter 15, there's a whole spiel of if you want to stay with your master for the rest of your life voluntarily, there was a way to do it. Now, why would that be in the law if nobody would want to do it? Because for some people, it was the most stable situation they could find. I will live on your farm. All of my work will go to your business, but you will take care of me and house me and feed me and my family. And they felt safe enough to give themselves over for the rest of their life. They could do it voluntarily. Because for some people, that was the best situation they were going to find. And it was a lot safer to be there than to be on their own in a situation where they couldn't actually take care of their family. Their advantage that to being a servant underneath the master's household, that they were a part of that household. They were fed, sheltered, and looked after, even as members of their own family. Now, I want to make a side point, number three. I'm going to make this quickly because I really want to move on to the last point before we're done. There is value in being part of God's people. There is value in being part of God's people. In Leviticus chapter 25, he does make a distinction between the foreigners in the land and the Israelites in the land. Now, God had given the land to Israel, and there was going to be some people who still lived and worked there. But rather than throwing them in prison, and rather than executing them by taking their land, what they do was they're given a permission to work in the land. They were given permission to become workers and even to become people of means. In Leviticus 25:47, there's an insinuation that some of the foreigners were going to be rich at times. So there was allowance for that. However, even though the Bible makes a distinction, we have to recognize that if there were foreigners in the land, a lot of them had chosen to be there because it was easier to make money. But because they had chosen to be there and they weren't part of God's people, then they didn't get as many benefits. For example, they would be charged interest if they chose to do business in the land. I want to make a couple side notes, though, as we move on. Letter A, the people of Israel were still commanded to be kind to strangers. Strangers were considered to be people who lived there but were not Israelites. They were commanded to be kind to them. Leviticus 19, verse 33 says, if a stranger sojourn with thee in your land, you shall not vex him. For the stranger that dwells with you shall be unto you as one born among you, and thou shalt love him as thyself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Many of them had chosen to voluntarily live there, and they were supposed to treat them well. Exodus 22, I read this verse earlier, thou shalt neither vex a stranger or oppress him, because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. However, letter B, rejecting or fighting God came with less blessing. Rejecting or fighting God comes with less blessing. There was different rules, like I just mentioned a minute ago. They weren't supposed to give interest to an Israelite, but you could give interest to a foreigner. But if a foreigner is living in God's land and is making a lot of money, then they're choosing to benefit off of the blessings of God. But if they had chosen to be there that way, then they don't get as many benefits. We say, that's cruel. Well, no, it's not. If you're a Florida resident, you'd get a discount on Disney World. There's benefits for living in Florida. If you want to benefit from the Florida stuff, then if you're a resident of Florida, there's benefits to it. Likewise, if you were part of God's people living in God's land, then there was benefits for being that. And if you wanted to come in, you could. They're just some of the benefits were not available to you. Prisoners of war were considerations as well. They weren't supposed to go and steal people. That was actually really significant. We're going to come back to that in just a second. But there were instances where soldiers who were fighting against God's people were captured and not killed. And so what do you do with them? Well, they could be workers in the land of Israel and treated like the rest of the servants and given the protections and the provisions for them, or they would be killed. The prisoner of war was treated well as a servant. Remember the Gibeonites in Joshua chapter 9? They lied to the Israelites. They made a treaty with them, and they said, well, you will be hewers of wood and drawers of water. He says, if you want to stay with us, we'll be good with you, but then you work on the land, and so we both benefit. And they said, cool, fine deal with us. And they stayed, because that's what they wanted to be. This is better than prisons and work camps. And like I said a minute ago, there was even a way for a foreigner to become a person of means. In that passage, Leviticus 25:47, it talks about how a foreigner would be rich, even when his Israelite neighbor was not. that was even possible. So yes, there was benefit to being part of God's people, but it was not nearly as bad as it's often posed to be. Now, number four is very important. This is some of the revolutionary ideas that the law of Moses introduced when it comes to servants and workers. The law of Moses had, this is your blank, safeguards. Safeguards in a slave-filled world. That safeguards in a slave-filled world. Christopher Wright, one of my authors, he talked about in the law of Moses, there's kind of three major categories of things he deals with. Some things he talks about prohibiting and rejecting this. This is absolutely against God. Do not ever do it. Such as things would come to sexual morality or stealing, lying, bearing false witness. Those kinds of things were absolutely wrong. There was other things that were critical to affirm. You must say that this is right because this is how the world works. And then there's a lot in the law of Moses that finds its way into this weird gray area in the middle, which he called qualified toleration. You live in a world that's going to function this way. We're going to regulate in a way to get rid of its worst parts. And that's what it did. One of my authors said this, it's once again typical of the law's instructions that they start with how things work in the real world. And they focus on the practicalities of compromise between the interests of the impoverished and the interests of the people who can help them. And so he says, so the masters who want to make it good for them so that they can be in a position to help those who are poorer. And so here's some regulations that the law of Moses actually put. Now, before I get into these, this last point's very important because one of our biggest issues when we say, wow, slavery existed in the Bible and we just feel like the conversation's done, is we dump onto that everything that we know slavery to be, which are all bad things. That somebody would be owned for life. They'd be considered less than human. They were probably kidnapped and trafficked. They might be abused. All the things we consider to be slavery, all the things we dump onto that term, all of those things were specifically prohibited in the law of Moses. I'm going to give them to you. Letter A. Servants were commanded to be treated with dignity. They were commanded to be treated with dignity. One of the Bible dictionaries that I have that's considered more secular said this, we have in the Bible the first appeals in world literature, in history, to treat slaves as human beings for their own sake and not just for the interests of their masters. The law of Moses was the first thing in world literature to begin to treat slaves as humans just by themselves. Nobody else was doing that. Now remember, when you see servants, many of them are considered very honorable. Remember in Genesis chapter 15, where Abraham didn't have a son, and Abraham's proposition to God was, I can just pass on all of my inheritance and the promise of the blessing to all the nations. I can just pass that on to my servant, Eliezer. In his mind, his servant could be the heir of the promise of Abraham. Now, that wasn't God's design, but in Abraham's mind, that was perfectly reasonable. Later on, when God commands him to circumcise his family as a sign that they were part of God's people, he specifically says to do so also to his servants. Now, we would be like, oh, that's cruel. Well, the point of that whole thing was he was associating all of his family with God's people and the promise of Abraham. And he wanted all the people in his house to also be considered part of God's people and the promise of Abraham. So he puts them into the same category. Elijah had a servant, Elisha, who was also his successor, to follow him. The people in all the house, by the way, they worked together. Where the master owned the field, all the children in the family would work on the farm, and so were the servants, and they were treated the same. Remember in Galatians chapter 4, a few weeks ago when I was walking through the book of Galatians, where it talks about how we're supposed to be sons of God? It specifically says that as we grow up under households, servants and children, there's hardly a distinction between the two. I'll read it to you. Remember this? I say an heir, as long as he is a child, differeth nothing from a servant, though he be lord of all. Why would they say that? Because that's how a lot of the families worked. The servants were treated differently than the children, and the children weren't treated differently. So several ways that this showed up. Exodus 12:44, slaves were included in the religious life of the community. They were to be circumcised as part of God's people, and they were also to partake in the Passover. Deuteronomy 16, they were allowed to join in the feasting and the celebrations. They were considered part of the Israelite community. Exodus 20, verse 10, the regulation to take a day of rest every week was supposed to be also participated in by the servants. So just like everyone else got a rest day that week, the servants were supposed to get a rest day that week as well. Even people who would otherwise not be allowed to participate in eating of the sacrifices at the temple itself, only the Levites were allowed to actually partake of the sacrifices. But if you were a worker in the Levite's household, you were considered a Levite, and you got to eat of the holy sacrifices as well, even when another Israelite wasn't allowed to. They were commanded to be treated with dignity. Letter B, the flip side of that. Masters were commanded to be good. Masters were commanded to be good. In Leviticus, I gave you a couple passages, Leviticus 25, 43, 46, 53. It adds that a servant's master should not rule over him with harshness. The idea of those Hebrew words is that they weren't supposed to be violent or even give them back-breaking labor. They would be reasonable with the people who work for you. And this extends all the way to the New Testament. When the Bible talks to masters, he says in Colossians 4, give unto your servants that which is just and equal, knowing that ye have a master in heaven. Ephesians 6, ye masters do the same things unto them, forbearing threatening, knowing that your master also is in heaven. Neither is there respect of persons with him. Masters were commanded to be good. Servants were commanded to be treated with dignity. Letter C, injured servants would be released. Injured servants would be released. I don't have time to read the whole passage because we're already way late, but I want to give you these last couple things so we can be done. And there's a passage in Exodus chapter 21. You can go back and read it later. It specifically says that if a master beat or injured his servant, that servant was automatically to go free. It was not a house to stay in. You can go free. If he killed his servant, the master would receive the death penalty. And it says later on in this passage, talking about other situations where vulnerable people were taken advantage of. It says a life for a life, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. That whole passage is about when you injure those below you who are vulnerable, you will pay it the same. The masters were required to treat them well. And he says, under situations where you maybe accidentally hurt them and they survive a little while, he says, what you're doing, he says, he is your money, he says in that passage. But what that means is he's your source of income. You're only hurting yourselves, he reminds the master. When you hurt your workers, you're hurting yourself. So be kind to your servants. But if you're not, they're allowed to go. They're commanded to go. Like, we can come and get them and take them away. Letter D, human trafficking was strictly forbidden. Human trafficking was strictly forbidden. Often what we associate with slavery is the slave trade, where you go to some other country and you get people and you bring them back. But it was strictly forbidden. Exodus 21, 16, it says, he that stealeth a man and selleth him, or if he be found in his hand, that man shall be surely put to death. Human traffickers receive death penalty under the law of Moses. Deuteronomy 24 says, if a man be found stealing any of his brethren of the children of Israel and maketh merchandise of him or selleth him, then that thief shall die, that thou shalt put evil away from among you. So did Americans actually use the Bible to justify their slavery the way that they practice it? Yes, they did. But what they did not do is use the Bible right, because all the things that the slave trade involved were directly commanded against in the Bible. One more, letter E. Runaway slaves were to be helped. Runaway slaves were to be helped. Deuteronomy 23 says, thou shalt not deliver unto his master the servant which is escaped from his master unto thee. He, the servant, will dwell with thee even among you in that place which he shall choose in one of thy gates, where it liketh him best, and thou shalt not oppress him. In every other culture, if a slave ran away, the slave was to be punished and brought back to the master. No questions asked. But in the law of Moses, he says, if a slave ran away from his master, apparently there was a reason to run away. So harbor him and let him live wherever he wants and be kind to him. Don't oppress him. So here's the point. There's a lot more things I could call up. There was a lot of things I gave to you, but here's the point. The Bible was written in the ancient world. It was. We can get mad at that, but that's just when it was written. And the world was filled with people who owned other people and oppressed other people. And anything to get done, some people weren't landowners. My brother even said it this way. For us to say the Bible should have condemned slavery is to say that literally in the ancient world, what we're saying is every single person was supposed to be a landowner and a business owner. And that's just not how the world works. And especially that's not how the world worked back then. And so if somebody was going to live, many of them were going to work for somebody else. And that would be the word that was associated with them. But what the Bible does do with slavery is regulate in a way that the ancient world knew nothing about and gave humanity and dignity to the people that nobody else treated well. In fact, what the law of Moses really does is say that God cares about the vulnerable people in a way that nobody else does. God's design is for us to see each other as equal. And as you flip forward in the Bible, what you see is the equality between people and society generally and gradually evening out. So that not only do I see you as a worker underneath my house, I begin to see you as a brother beloved and better than myself. And that was the design. And it was through the New Testament and the commands that Jesus gave that the abolitionists actually used and championed in order to completely get rid of slavery in the modern world today. And so, yes, is there slavery in the Bible? Well, there's slavery in the ancient world. And God put a lot of things on it in order to take care of people the best way that the society possibly could. And that's what they did. So that was slavery today. We're going to talk about war next time.